You don't need to be worried about me preaching. Football's over. We got time. We got time. This morning, we are going to be wrapping up this series we've been in. We've spent 3 weeks really surveying the religious landscape of the culture that we've been embedded in. And my hope is that what you've taken away is that perhaps the topography is a little more complex than what we would have assumed. It's what Tara Burton describes as religiously remixed. We might use the word syncretism. Essentially, people are going out and we're just kind of picking and choosing beliefs. No longer are we embracing whole hog religious traditions in their totality, the whole package. We take a little bit from here, a little bit from there. It's what she describes as intuitionally driven religion. It's where we have bought into this idea that our gut, our feelings, will tell us more than what our heads will. Which is kind of a frightening thought, isn't it? And all of these intuitional religions, she tells us, at the root are religions of the self. What we looked at last week is, because this is our culture, and culture's water, and we're the fish, so we don't always realize that we're always wet. This worship of self, or maybe to use Paul's language, self-life, it dies hard sometimes. And we'll find it creeping up back in our own lives, sometimes in the strangest of places, sometimes in church. As we've gathered together to worship God, we still see the worship of self. It's still sometimes subtly there. So what I want to do this morning is wrap this up and address this question. If everything we've said thus far is true, what then does it mean for the church moving into the future? What does it mean for us to be embedded in this sort of culture and this sort of reality? And I'll just suggest to you this morning that my best guess is that in the future, and not the distant future, much of what we have come to expect of church will change. It will probably look very different than what most of us grew up with, I think. Miss Burton tells us that religion provides us with four essential things. It tells us about meaning, tells us about purpose, it gives us community, and it gives us ritual. I want to focus this morning on that last one, on ritual, because ritual, it tends to take you to the heart of religion. Now, you can define religion many different ways. I've got a couple definitions myself, but I was curious to see what Google would give you if you looked it up. And honestly, the definition they gave wasn't too bad if you just used the first half of it. The definition you'll find if you go looking is, religion is the belief in and worship of, and then you don't really need the rest. That's actually pretty good. Religion is belief in and worship of. And everybody is religious. It's a human impulse. All of us believe in something. Even if it's nothing more than ourselves, we believe in something. And remember, the word worship comes from the idea of worth-ship. Everybody has something of ultimate value in their life. There's something to you that is more important than all the other somethings. And when we have something that's important, we wrap our time and our energy and our money and our talent and our abilities. We invest all that into that thing. That's worship. So you may only believe in yourself, and you might be the most important person in your world, and you might be of highest worth to you. But you're going to worship something. And because we are human and we have this religious impulse, guess what? Everything important gets a ritual. Did you know? Everything important gets a ritual, right? Think about it. Marriage. People who are getting married, they think it's important. So what do? We have rituals for that. I mean, even if you strip it down to bare bones, if it's just you and your significant other and you go to the justice of the peace and the justice of the peace says, do you? Yep. Do you? Yep. Sign the paper. Still a ritual. It's not a very exciting one, but it's a ritual nonetheless because marriage is important. You're going to have a baby? Oh, we got rituals for that. You're going to have a baby? Baby shower. Or one worse, a gender reveal party, which every man in this room thinks is ridiculous. But if it's important, it gets a ritual, right? Graduation. Graduation's a pretty done-up ritual, isn't it? Because it's a big accomplishment. It's a big mile marker in life. Congratulations. You've made it. You did it. Now you get to wear a black dress. All of us? Yeah, everybody. And a goofy-looking hat with string hanging off of it. Who made that decision? Wouldn't you have enjoyed to sit in on the committee meeting where these sorts of decisions were made? I mean, I can imagine a professor sitting there and saying, you know, we're honoring them for this great accomplishment, but let's be honest, they're not all graduating equal, are they? Some of them got 4.0, straight A's, good students. Some of these kids, we're letting them through by the skin of their teeth. Isn't there something we can do at graduation to honor the ones who did a really good job? And somebody pipes up, yeah, hang some ropes around their neck. What? Ropes? Yeah, but call them honor cords. They're going to love it. So we do that. What about the ones who have more degrees? Give them goofy, pointy sleeves. Sleeves? Yes, sleeves. And a hood. A hood to keep the rain off? No, you don't wear it over your head. It just kind of chokes your neck and hangs off the back like a cape that doesn't give you any superpowers. And somebody in this meeting has said, nobody's going to do this. It's ridiculous. Don't worry, the professors will do it every year, all the time. That joke's funny if you realize my mom, who's visiting, is a professor. It's for you. So you get to the graduation ceremony. You've made it. After hours and hours of studying and reading and tests and homework and classes, you've arrived. And now you get to move the string from one side of your hat to the other. Here's $80,000 in debt. Go make something of yourself. But everything important gets a ritual. Some of them are big, like graduation and weddings, but some rituals, they're personal. They're just for us. There's probably a lot of things in your life that are, in fact, rituals. You just didn't know it. If you're the sort of person that you care about how you present yourself to other people, your appearance matters, you probably have rituals. Some of you women have rituals about how you put your makeup on. It's borderline religious, but it's a ritual. I bought a book last week about woodworking, and it might surprise you guys to know I don't usually do that. I don't actually own very many woodworking books. For as much as I'm interested in that, and I also read a lot of books, I don't have too many. But I got one, and it's a book about the philosophy of woodworking. Now, I know when I say that, most of you are like, this guy's got a problem. He needs some help. He has too much time on his hands. I get it. But it's a very interesting book. And the guy writes the book recognizing that most woodworkers are not professional. So when we go into the shop, our top concern is not just like banging boards together and getting product out there to sustain a livelihood. Most of us are hobbyists. And so his premise is that when we go to the shop, what we really are desiring is meaningful shop time and meaningful work. Meaningful shop time and building meaningful pieces of whatever it is we're making. Well, do you know what he recommends to have a more meaningful experience? He doesn't say this, but this is what he says. Embracing more rituals. He doesn't use the word, but that's what he's talking about. He describes his ritual of entering into the shop space. He says, I begin by washing my hands. And I thought, that's that's interesting, because for a very long time, hand washing has been a ritualistic, symbolic gesture in a lot of different religions. Interesting. So he washes his hands, he comes into the shop, he turns on the music, he begins to put on his shop apron, he sticks all the tools in there, and I'm like, that sounds a lot like religious vestments. This is very interesting. And these are the things he does to have more meaningful time in the shop, because that's how rituals work. Rituals provide us with things like structure and order and continuity, but I think more than anything else, rituals express meaning. They tell us what a thing means. It's symbolizing significance, but as we enact rituals, it's the way that we act in the meaning of things. It's how we participate in meaning. And something very powerful can happen when groups of people gather together and engage in rituals. It has incredible potential to create community. You don't believe me? Go watch a college football game in the stadium of a team you don't normally cheer for and it isn't a rival. And engage with all the rituals. And trust me, college football's got plenty of them. There's plenty of symbolism, the colors, the mascot, the pageantry, and they've got their songs and they've got their cheers. Wear the colors and say the cheers and watch what happens. You'll get caught up in the experience of it, won't you? More than likely. And all of a sudden, you start feeling inside of yourself a desire to see the home team win. And if it works out that the game's close and they win right at the end, you're going to celebrate just like everybody else. You're going to see somebody and you're going to give them a hug. Because they're wearing the right, they're a complete stranger, but they got the right colors on and they said the right cheers. For the next 5 minutes, you might as well be family. Because when we engage in rituals together and when we say the same words and think the same thoughts, it creates connections. Rituals are really, really important. And in a church, almost all of our rituals, almost all of them, are about worship. Now, I've got a theory I'm going to share with you. After you have the question of belief settled, after that's taken care of, and after you more or less have an accurate picture in your mind of who God has revealed himself to be, after those two things are more or less squared away, I think most of the problems in the spiritual religious life come back to an inadequate understanding of worship or an inability to live it out in our lives. Let me say that again. Once you've got the question of belief settled, you've chosen to believe in God and all that the Bible says, and once you have a reasonably clear picture of who God has revealed himself to be in Scripture, once that's taken care of, the rest of the problems in the spiritual life, I think most of them, come back to an issue of an inadequate understanding of worship and the role worship plays in our lives. So I'm about to talk about worship, and here's the thing. I'm going to tell you all things that you already know. I'm just not sure we know them yet. Do you see the difference? We know these things. But have we figured out how to live them? You know already, I think, I hope, that worship is everything. Worship is everything because worship is an expression of a relationship. Worship is an expression of a relationship. And because we're Protestant, because we're evangelical, one of the things that we tend to emphasize is the reality that that relationship is personal. Yes, it's corporate, right? We talk about the relationship between God and his church and me belonging to this community. So it's corporate, but it's also personal. It's not transactional. It's personal, which is to say nobody can worship for you. It's something you have to figure out how to do for yourself, because it's an expression of a relationship you profess to have. Worships everything. But sometimes the problem is that we've bought into this idea that worship is something that happens in a building we call the church. And by the way, the building's not the church. You're the church. It's just a building. It's a nice building, isn't it? Y'all the church. But we buy into this idea that worship is something that happens here at a fixed time, and we kind of think it's going to happen whether we're there or not. And I understand how it is that we got here, that we think these sort of thoughts. We have a very long history of this sort of problem, particularly in the Western church. It's not exclusively a Western problem, but it's definitely our problem. And it is something of a problem of architecture. It's that most of our churches are built more or less like this. There's a platform or a stage, sometimes we call it an altar. It tends to be elevated, and there's some good common sense reasons for it. Because if whoever's up here is elevated, the person in the back can see, and you can participate, and that's really nice, isn't it? But we've organized our churches where there's an altar or a stage up front, and then there's chairs or pews, and just rows of them to the back. And it creates kind of this bifurcated reality. And it's like we begin to think that the real action happens up here, not down here. The problem is that we've structured our churches in the same way that we structured our theaters. And our other problem is that our culture is way too over-entertained. And so it's very, very easy for us to buy into this mentality that we're spectators, that we're the audience. That out here is where the audience sits, and up here is where all the action happens. That's what the worship team's up here for. And maybe you have a pastor, and he's kind of over to the side, and he's like the director or the conductor, and his or her job is to orchestrate this performance. And it's supposed to honor God. But you're going to watch. And maybe sometimes you'll participate. The problem is that is absolutely wrong. It's absolutely wrong. If this stage represents anything, it is the conductor's box. It's the director's box. If we're going to stick with our theater metaphor. But here's what you need to understand. This is the stage. You're sitting on it. You guys. This is the stage, and we're all playing for an audience of one. You're not the audience. He is. He is. And whatever happens up here is just prompting for what is really to go on out there. And it's for him. It's a different way of thinking about it, isn't it? But we've not been conditioned to think that way. I wasn't conditioned to think that way. Because I know how it goes when we leave. You guys know, sometimes I feel like I got to remind you, there was actually a time before I was a preacher. You remember this? Yes. You weren't privy to it, but it happened. And before I was a preacher, I sat out there and I kind of watched. And then I went home and did what everybody else did. We talked about how good or not good the sermon was, or how good or not good the music was. And that's the temptation, isn't it? When we slip into this idea that we're the audience, The next step is to become the critic. Oh, that's dangerous for your soul, church. It's dangerous for your soul. There is a church in Marion, Indiana, where I went to college. It's called College Wesleyan. And some of you here know the preacher. His name is Steve Deneff. I like Steve a lot. He is one of, if not the best preacher in the Wesleyan church. But sometimes being that good creates some problems, because I personally have known people that they will go to College Wesleyan on a Sunday morning, and if they find out that Steve isn't preaching, they'll leave. Because they think they're the audience. They've forgotten that they're the actors. And that you're sitting on the stage right now. Because this isn't about the expression of a relationship between you and your preacher or you and your worship team. In fact, it doesn't really matter who's preaching, does it? I'm not the only one who gets evaluated today. The audience is going to make an assessment. I wonder if he'll be pleased with what we offered him on that stage. Do you guys know that the Old Testament, from a certain perspective, it's all about worship? It is. Almost the whole Old Testament is about worship. Now, that is embedded in a story about salvation. It's a story about a God who has a relationship. Remember, worship is an expression of relationship. It's about a God who starts a relationship with this guy named Abraham, and he kind of carries it on with the family, his son, his grandson, until the family grows into a mighty nation. Only problem is they're in slavery, and so God shows up, and he delivers the whole nation, and he takes them out to Sinai, and that's where they're supposed to worship God or have this relationship with God. And God says, here's the deal. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to keep all of my promises. I'm going to do everything I ever said I would do for you. But this is an exclusive relationship. It's monogamous. No other gods. I'll be faithful to you. You'll be faithful to me. That's how this works. And then there's lots of laws given. And some of them, they make sense when you realize when the God who created everything moves into a tent that's in the middle of our tent city, you'd better live a certain way. But what you notice if you read through them, and I know a lot of us don't, they're hard to get through, how many of these laws deal with the minutiae of worship? Why? Because worship matters. Because worship is an expression of a relationship, and you got to get that right with God. It matters. And so then the whole rest of the Old Testament is how Israel failed. How they didn't worship God the way he wanted to be worshiped, and that stuff matters. But more often than not, how they brought in other gods. God said, mm-mm. This is to be an exclusive relationship. And what you discover is that it's not until the very end of the Old Testament, it's not until after they've gone off into exile, come back, and figured out, oh, maybe we should worship God and God alone. Maybe we should worship him in the way that he prescribed for us. It wasn't until after the people got to that point that God said, okay, now you're ready for the next stage. Now you're ready for the next stage of revelation, Jesus Christ. But first they had to get the relationship right, and they had to get worship right. So worship is an expression of relationship, but here's the thing. Worship is also the overflow of love. Have you ever spent time around a young couple, I know it can be painful having to listen to the things that young couples who are deeply and desperately in love will say to each other. Oh, you're just so wonderful. I don't deserve you. Oh, no, you're more wonderful than I am. Oh, no, you're more wonderful than I am. Oh, just, I love the way your eyes sparkle in the candlelight. And all the rest of us have thrown up in our mouths. Thank you very much. But they can't help themselves. They're adoring one another. And it's not by accident that the Bible uses the word adoration in the context of worship. Read through the Bible, and what you will find is that sort of a gushing love is how we're supposed to feel about God. You see it in the Psalms. You see it in the Song of Solomon. It's not exactly the PG version, but most scholars agree that Song of Solomon, it's a love poem. We'll leave it at that. That is really a metaphor about our love for God and God's love for us. It's one of those books where you're reading, you're like, does that mean what I think it means? Yes, it does. Yes, it does. But you see it in the Psalms. It's about the overflow of love. And you get to Matthew chapter 24, and Jesus says, one of the signs you should watch out for is when the love of many grows cold. There's nothing that's more sad, I think, than a couple who has lived together for years and years and years, and after all of that faithfulness, all they're doing is living together. They're just roommates. They're not lovers anymore. Love that has grown cold is sad. You guys see what I did there? Talking about love growing cold on Valentine's Day, on the coldest day of the year. You can't write this stuff any better. When love grows cold, unexpressed love is a painful love. Yes? You know this if you were young and you had a crush on somebody and you were never able to tell them. There's all that feeling and passion, but because it's not expressed, it just burns within. It's still true of other forms of love. Whenever I have to travel for work, I miss my family. I do. I miss my wife. I miss my boys. I miss giving them hugs and kisses and saying goodnight. I don't miss picking up after them, but I miss them. And calling them on Zoom is just not the same thing, because unexpressed love is painful. If it's real, you got to get it out. You got to do something with it. But if this is the only place that we worship, and remember, worship is an expression of a relationship, it's an overflow of love. If this is the only place we worship, and it never happens during the rest of the week, I don't know how much that happens for people. I'm going to guess for the average church attender in America, this is probably it. There's not much else. And then I think about how many Christians, let's just be honest, they only get to church once a month, once every other month. Now look, I'm not talking about you guys. It's the coldest day of the year. You guys are like the Navy SEALs of church attenders. Like, you bless my heart. But do we not stop and ask the question? If there's not something burning in you that needs to be expressed, is there much love? If we can't not help ourselves in worship, do we need to be worried that in the church, love's grown cold? Do we have churches that are full of roommates? Yes, we have a relationship with God. We just haven't done much with it yet. Or recently. And if that's true, what do we do? Can I just suggest to you this morning that cold love is not a normative Christian experience. It wasn't meant to be. Paul, after developing something of a rather complicated argument about how things are for the church, for Jews, for Gentiles, in the book of Romans, he finally gets to chapter 12, and he begins his kind of therefore. It's the application section. And this is the first verse. He says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Now, the Apostle Paul has this incredible ability of saying a whole bunch of things in a relatively compact space. He's telling us, for one, that worship, it engages the totality of our being. There's this idea that somehow worship is like a spiritual thing, but what I do with my body, which is, in our minds, not spiritual, my own business. Paul says, no, that's not how it works. It's your body is supposed to be a living sacrifice. Only place in all of Scripture, by the way, that those two words appear next to each other. Sacrifices aren't usually alive. Not how it works, unless you're a Christian. Then that's how it works. What you do with your body actually really, really matters. It matters to God. And what you do with your body is, in fact, spiritual worship. And maybe it's just me, but I hear echoes in Paul of what Jesus said in John chapter 4 when he meets the Samaritan woman by the well. She's trying to figure out, well, should we worship on this mount? Should we worship on that mount? She said, that's not the point. He says, listen, an hour is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, because that's the sort of worshipers that the Father seeks. That's an interesting thought, that God is actually actively seeking people to worship Him, to express that relationship that they have with Him, to offer Him up an overflow of the love of their heart. And then in Hebrews chapter 13, we get another verse that provides a picture of the normative Christian experience. It says, through Him, that's Jesus, then, let us continually, pause, he doesn't say occasionally, continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God. That's the sacrifice. Praise, that is the fruit of lips that acknowledge His name. So worship is a sacrifice of praise. It's a sacrifice of myself. It's an expression of relationship. It's an overflow of love. And it is supposed to consume all of my being. What if that's not the reality? What if the love has grown cold? Well, let me say a couple things about that. One, love is as much action as it is feeling. It's at least as much part will as it is heart. Paul told us that in 1 Corinthians. We read that this morning. So love isn't just how you feel. Love is also what you do. But if you're worried about the feeling part, I've got good news and I've got bad news. Your feelings are highly manipulatable. Now, that's bad news if you're like me, if you're a millennial and you're part of a generation who's abandoned reason and embraced their feelings. That's disconcerting. But it is good news because when you do what love does, usually your feelings will get in line. So if you act out your love when you don't feel the love, in short order, the feelings will get in line. So can I tell you, if this morning you're saying, you know, maybe the love has grown cold for me, I don't always feel the love for God that I think I should, then do what love does, whatever that is. This is good marriage advice, by the way. See, too often, men, we only get flowers when we did something dumb. Because men are going to do dumb things. Amen? None of the men said amen. Come on now, we got to get honest here, church. We tell the truth here. So we do something dumb, and we get flowers to butter up. Get flowers before you do something dumb. Well, I don't feel like getting flowers. Get flowers anyhow. It'll be okay. Women, sometimes your man's going to do something dumb, and you're not going to be feeling the love, and you're going to be waiting for those flowers. Do something for your man before he gets you the flowers. That's not how this works. It is if you want to feel the love. But figure out what it is love would do, regardless of how you feel, and do that. And in short order, then the feelings will return. Something else I would commend to you, if you're not feeling the love, tell your story. I realized, Amanda and I, we do this probably more often than what we think. We've been married for 10 years now, and even still, we reminisce about the good old days. We talk about our relationship back in high school and college when we were young and I was doing lots of dumb things. She reminds me of them. She's like, you were so insensitive and dumb back then. I was like, high school boy, what were you hoping for? And it's not like we don't know the stories. Of course, I haven't forgotten. We know the stories. We tell them over and over, but in the recounting of the story, we re-enter the meaning of the story. Do you realize that's why the Old Testament tells the story of the Exodus over and over and over again? It's in prayers, it's in psalms, it's in songs, it's in the prophets. It's all over the place. The Jews are always talking about the Exodus. Why? Because that's their love story. They're taking themselves back to the place where love was new and fresh, and they're rekindling it, and they're reminding themselves of what it all means. So if you're not feeling the love, maybe you need to take some time by yourself and write down your love story. What was your conversion experience? What was it that brought you to God? And how were you changed? Write it down. And then a little while later, write it down again. And then maybe after a year or two, you do it again. I had to do it many times. They required it in school. It was a really good exercise for me. It rekindles the love. So write down your love story or share it with somebody. Okay. Some of you have been paying attention. You're like, wait a minute. I thought you were going to talk about the church. That's what you said. And somehow we started talking about rituals, and now we're talking about love. I'll tie it all together for us. I do not think churches moving into the future will survive unless they are able to find their own voice in worship. And there are lots and lots and lots and lots of churches that are going through all of the motions of worship, but they haven't found their voice. There are lots of churches that are full of spectators instead of worshipers. And if this morning you're here to spectate, I suspect you won't be here very long. That's how spectator churches work. Because if you're here for certain songs, the songs will eventually change, and then you'll leave. If you're here for good messages, there'll probably be a season where I'm going to preach a bunch of stinkers, and then you're going to leave. Whatever it is, that reason you're here for, when it's no longer a part of the equation, people leave. unless this is just the place we've decided to gather together to offer up our sacrifice of praise because we owe it to Him. And somehow we've found that true voice of worship and we've realized that's the stage, not this. This is the director's box. My job is not to be the soloist. It's to prompt the choir. That's my job. A couple weeks ago, I had a conversation with Abby Buller, and I got her permission to share the story, by the way. And we were talking about church things, and she said, hey, I've got this idea. Could we start having more regular sharing times in church? I said, well, of course we can do that. That'd be great. Because normally we do it once a year, right? At the very last Sunday of the year, we have a testimony Sunday because that's a great way to transition, isn't it? To give God glory for what happened the year before and maybe find some hope for the year ahead. Like, it's good. She said, why don't we do it more often? Because it's so encouraging to hear other Christians talk about what's going on in their lives. I said, Abby, this is a fantastic idea. I would love to do this. I said, I'd love to do it. I'm not sure people will buy in. I'm not sure we'll have enough people to do it on a very regular basis. She said, oh, I've got a bunch of people that said they'd want to do it. I was like, really? She said, yeah, but they didn't want to talk to you. Really? Am I that unapproachable? I'm sorry. She said, yeah, they didn't want to come across like they were telling you what to do. You all know, right? I'm not the church boss. Someone can say amen. It's fine. I'm not the church boss. And guess what? I'm not actually paid to have all the best ideas. It's not my job description. Actually, I don't have a job description. But if I did, it wouldn't be in there. Because sometimes you guys are going to have much better ideas than me. My job is not to be the soloist. My job is to lead the choir. Can I tell you what sort of church I would love to be a part of? It's the sort of church that Paul describes in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. He says this, what then, brothers? When you come together, catch this, each one, not the pastor, not the worship team, each one has a hymn, a lesson, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. So let all things be done for building up. If any speaks in a tongue, let there be only two or the most three, and each in turn, and let someone interpret. But if there is no one to interpret, let each of them keep silent in the church and speak to himself and to God. Let two or three prophets speak and let the others weigh what is said. If a revelation is made to another sitting there, let the first be silent. For you can all prophesy one by one so that all may learn and all be encouraged. And the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. For God is not a God of confusion, but of peace. What a cool picture. It's a picture of a church where everybody shows up with the worship pump primed. You've got songs. You've got words of encouragement. You've got prayers to offer. And we're just getting together to share them. All my job is to kind of keep things a little organized because that's what Paul's getting after here. There's a tendency because we are fallen humans. When we come with that worship pump primed, we're like so excited. Sometimes we're not paying attention to others. And so sometimes we get ahead of ourselves and we're so excited to worship God. And so somebody has to have the job of kind of like corralling. How many of you have been in choir? Okay, a couple of you. Do we have any sopranos in the room? Oh, look at those divas. Sopranos always think it's all about them. I don't know why it's that way. And so sometimes you need a director to say, sopranos, it's good. Just a little less. A little less. Any basses in the room? Yeah. They see the bass like, yeah, I guess. We need more bass, right? That's the director's job, to help maintain order. But here's the thing. I'm not going to have all the good ideas. Let's talk about rituals for a minute, because rituals are that clearest expression of our worship. Yes? Rituals always come from one of two places. You either borrow the traditional ones or you make up your own. And each one has its advantages and disadvantages. With traditional rituals, the advantage is that if they've stood the test of time, they're probably very biblical, they're probably theologically accurate, they've been thought out, and they're kind of polished, and they just work. The disadvantage is that sometimes it's hard to engage the heart. Because for a ritual to really be meaningful, your heart has to be engaged. And so this is what people complain about with very traditional liturgies. It's like, oh, we're just saying the words. No, you got to get your heart engaged. And if you do that well, they can be profoundly meaningful, deeply meaningful, and very powerful. But the work there is getting the heart engaged. Because we didn't write these. We're just borrowing them. If we write our own rituals and our own worship and our own liturgy, the heart tends to be pretty engaged because this is our stuff. It's by its own nature meaningful. The work is you have to be careful that it's right and accurate and worthy of God. This is what the writer of Hebrews cautioned in the previous chapter. He said, therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship. Implication being there are forms of worship that are unacceptable, and Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians. Acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. You see, pay attention to who and what you're worshiping and allow that to direct your worship. So we can write our own worship, our own rituals, and I think we should. But the work is you got to be careful. You know what I think? It would be very appropriate in this community if somebody, can't be me, wrote a liturgy, a song, a prayer, something for the Thanksgiving of the harvest. Why does our church not have a liturgy, a ritual of Thanksgiving at the end of calving season? I don't know, call it a prayer branding. I don't know. But you understand, I can't write that. One of you has to write it. I've driven a tractor one time, and I'm really glad nobody was there to see it. Rodney let me do it. It was a lapse in judgment. I can't write that liturgy for you. I can help you. I can help make sure it's biblical and accurately reflects who God has revealed himself to be, but I can't write it. So what I'm really saying is that I think the only churches that are going to survive in the future are the ones that take ownership of their worship. We got to own that, each and every one of us. We've got to find the life habits that bring us to church, though we're the church. This is the gathering of the church that brings us here with the pump primed for worship. We've got to get rid of the stage mentality. It's not about me, and it's not about the worship team. This is just the director's box. That's the stage. I'm going to invite the worship team up, and we're going to close with a story, because we like stories, right? How many of you are familiar with the name Mike Pilavachi? Yeah, I thought so, just me. I've mentioned him before, but he's there. Yes, she knows. How many of you are familiar with the name Matt Redman? There we go, a little more familiar. Matt Redman is a pastor, singer, songwriter, but the story is really about Mike Pilavachi. Mike Pilavachi, he's a pastor in England. He leads, if this is not a contradiction in terms, a small megachurch. And many years back, Matt Redman, before he was Matt Redman, was his worship pastor. Now, you can imagine, if you have Matt Redman as your worship pastor, it's going to be pretty good. I mean, just on a technical level, like, it was really good in terms of the musicality and the performance and all of that. It was really good. But what Mike and the leadership team of the church became convinced of was that somewhere along the way, the church had lost its way in worship. That they were just going through the motions, that somehow whatever they were doing, it wasn't really worship. And the incredible worship that was happening up on the stage with the team was somehow a distraction, and that the church had lost its voice. So Mike Pilavachi did what everybody thought was insane. He took the band off the stage. He took the sound system out of the church. Like, physically removed it. And he just opened it up and he said, "What have you brought as a sacrifice of praise?" And that was it. There was no music. There was no preaching. There was a lot of really awkward silence and nervous glances around. And that was it. And then they all went home. And you can imagine, they're like, well, hopefully that doesn't happen again. Except the next week, the exact same thing happened again. No band, no preaching. What did you bring to offer to God? And there was nothing. And somebody came to him after the service, and they said, "Mike, you're going to kill this church. You can't keep doing this." He said, "I would rather kill a church than have a church that doesn't know how to worship." And he was persistent. And eventually something changed. They turned the corner, and all of a sudden people began spontaneously singing and praying together. And slowly this church found its voice, and then they brought back the sound system and they brought back the band. But from that moment on, everything was different in that congregation. Because people were really worshiping again. I want you to hear this with as much love as I have. I'd rather kill a church than have a church that doesn't know how to pray, that has a church that doesn't know how to worship, have a gathering of people that we're here for what we get and not the kingdom of God. At the end of that experience, Matt Redmond wrote the song, "Heart of Worship." And that's what we're going to close with this morning.